Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
People who have been to prison, on average, don't live as long as those who haven't. But a new study digs into one big contributor to that aggregate fact. A staggering number of ex-prisoners die in the days just after being released.
And an Indian star cricketer has been hit with a torrent of abuse after switching teams, sparking a bigger question about how much booing is too much booing. But first, recently, we've talked a lot on the show about the wonders of generative artificial intelligence, about its speed, its breadth of capabilities, from writing prose to generating code, and about the breakneck pace of its advancement. Investors have taken note too. OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, is valued at nearly $90 billion. Its partner, Microsoft, has a market capitalization of almost $3 trillion, making it the world's most valuable company. But not everyone is happy about how the AI firms develop their products.
In each business that I've led, successful new businesses were built on a foundation of licensing content rights.
Earlier this year, Condé Nast CEO, Roger Lynch, argued for congressional action to force AI companies to license the material that they use to create their language models.
Unfortunately, currently deployed GenAI tools have been built with stolen goods.
And the producers of what he calls those stolen goods sense an opportunity.
The problem is that these AI companies, when they were training their models, used data from all over the place, and this data was created by humans.
Tom Wainwright is The Economist's tech and media editor.
And now the humans and the companies who made that original data are looking at the multi-billion dollar valuations of these AI companies and saying, actually, we'd like a bit of that money as well, please.
Let's take a step back for a minute. Remind us how these generative AI models operate.
Well, they work by training on data created by people. It could be a novel by Dan Brown, it could be a piece of music, or it could be a video, or anything really. And they hoover up huge, huge quantities of this stuff. Once they've got the data, they then break it down into what they call tokens. So that could be words or parts of words. And then by process of trial and error, they rearrange those tokens to figure out how they typically go together in a normal sentence or a piece of music or what an ordinary photo looks like, for example. And it sounds kind of rudimentary, but when you repeat that process billions upon billions of times, it gradually learns, much as a human does really, how an ordinary sentence or photo or piece of music or whatever works. And so that's how you get these models where you can type in a query, a prompt, and it replies or gives you an image which looks or sounds or reads incredibly lifelike. The thing is, though, now these companies are getting a bit reluctant to say what kind of data they trained on in many cases. That, they say, is partly to give them a competitive advantage over their rivals, but people also think that they probably are trying to ward off any future lawsuits. You know, if you say, yeah, we trained our model on the back archive of The Economist or something, and it was incredibly useful, you're laying yourself open to legal challenges there. And so they've tended to get a little bit quiet. But it's pretty widely acknowledged that in their early days, at least, most of these models were trained on scrapings of the World Wide Web, much of which was subject to copyright.
Now, what do the companies who are making AI models say about using copyrighted material?
Well, they say it's okay. And really, there are two parts to this. The kind of moral or common sense defense that they have sometimes invoked is that they learn a bit like how humans learn. You know, I was talking to a songwriter the other day, and he was saying that every song he's ever written was really inspired by other pieces of music written by other people. And that's just considered fair use. You know, if a student reads a load of books and then writes an original essay, that essay can still be original, even if ultimately everything in it came, you know, in small part from other stuff. The retort to that is that these models work on a kind of superhuman scale, and so they should be subject to superhuman rules. You know, it's different if something can absorb billions of texts instead of a few dozen texts. So that's the kind of moral argument being played out at the moment. The legal argument is one that, in America at least, hinges on a concept called fair use. And this is a complex thing, but roughly speaking, it says that use of copyrighted material is okay under certain conditions. And there are various conditions, but one of the key ones is that your use of the material has to be what they call transformative. So if you're taking somebody else's work, but then turning it into something that's really completely different, then that's considered more okay than it would otherwise be. And the legal case that a lot of companies are citing as precedent is a case over Google Books, which was settled some years ago when a judge ruled that Google's use of these copyrighted texts was so transformative, you know, it was doing something so different that it was within fair use. And so it remains to be seen whether AI will be judged in the same way, but the AI companies are very much hoping that it will be.
But I'm guessing that the original creators of the work, the creators who own the copyrights, don't quite see it the way the companies do.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they have different views. Some publishers, including The Economist, are blocking AI companies' automated crawlers from scraping words from their websites. And meanwhile, we're seeing lots of legal cases at the moment being launched by creative content companies of all kinds. The New York Times is suing, Universal Music, the world's biggest record label, is suing, Getty Images, which is one of the biggest image databases, is suing. They're all taking legal action against these AI companies, saying that they use their copyrighted work without permission and that they now need paying. And I think that there's a feeling in all of these industries, really, that they got badly burned by an earlier era of the internet when a lot of material got used without consent or without payment by various tech companies in different ways. So we all remember the era when music was being shared on platforms like Napster. Google Images was another case that was fought and won in the end by Google. A lot of newspapers have seen their ad revenue being siphoned away over the years to search engines and social networks. And I think there's a real feeling among these companies that we got burned before, let's not let that happen again. And so they're getting in early now with their lawsuits.
Tom, what exactly is protected by copyright law?
Well, it varies from country to country, but broadly speaking, copyright law on the whole covers what they call creative expression rather than ideas or information. So to give an example, you know, think about a news story. If we report some company is defrauding its customers or something like that, our exact words could fall under copyright. So if somebody copied and pasted the whole article or paragraph after paragraph, that would be covered. But the news or information in that report is not covered by copyright. And there's a convention that if people are following up a story, they'll say, you know, as first reported in The Economist or whatever. But the information itself can't be copyrighted. It's only the creative expression. And this has an impact on the kind of level of protection that different industries have. So computer coding, for example, is not considered to be all that well protected by copyright, because on the whole, computer code is so functional. It's just doing a job rather than really expressing something creatively. The other end of the spectrum, you have things like artwork or photos, where, you know, that really is a creative expression. And so if you're copying someone's photo or piece of artwork or other image, you're on pretty thin ice there. So the kind of creative work that we're talking about, the level of copyright protection can vary quite a lot depending on what kind of work it is or what kind of industry we're in.
We heard at the start that Roger Lynch, an American publisher, is calling for government regulation. Tom, do you think that's the answer? Will it even happen?
It might happen. I mean, I spoke to one expert who said that copyright laws, which of course are, you know, in some cases, hundreds of years old, you know, they're being stretched to the limit, really, of what they were written for here with AI. And so we might see new laws. I think that probably it's ultimately going to depend on how these court cases go. People on the whole seem to think that on the kind of big fair use question, the courts are likely to agree that it probably is. And I think that if they don't, you know, if they turn around and say, actually, this whole industry is illegal, and they say all this stuff has to be dismantled. That's the point at which I think, you know, we might see Congress step in. At the moment, Congress seems pretty reluctant to do anything on this area, but I think if this massive industry were to be ruled essentially illegal, then you might see a congressman forced to do something. But for now, all the action is in the courts, so we'll have to wait and see what they rule.
Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Recently, our colleagues on Babbage, which is our weekly show on science and technology, concluded a four-part series looking at AI, how it works, and how it might develop in the future. If you missed it, fear not, it's not too late. You can subscribe to Economist Podcasts Plus or link your Economist account to your podcast player and take a listen now.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
It is quite a hostile environment in prison. You are placed in a housing situation unlike any other housing situation you will ever come across.
John Findlay is National Harm Reduction Lead at the charity Humankind.
Talking to people who are in prison and explaining that vulnerability is not a weakness in terms of being able to show that human vulnerability is really important. It's a very, very strange environment to live in, and one that's very hard not to have that shield almost up at all times of, I'm not going to show my emotions. I'm not going to show any signs of weakness because I'm fearful that someone might exploit that weakness whilst I'm in prison. And I think in the community, you don't need to have those things in place as much. Lots of things affect how well somebody does when they come out of prison. Somebody has to be ready to make some really big changes. Often, the only people you know when you come out of prison are the same people you knew before you went into prison. And some of those people might still be using drugs or drinking problematically. And to be around those people whilst they're doing that is extremely hard. You have to build up a resilience to those things.
More than 30 million people are released from prisons each year.
Slaveya Chankova is our healthcare correspondent.
Unsurprisingly, ex-prisoners die earlier than people who have never been to prison. What is striking, however, is how many of those deaths occur within just days of release.
So how many is it? Let's put some numbers to this.
Two academics in Australia, Rohan Borschmann and Stuart Kinner, led a consortium of researchers around the world to measure how high mortality was. And they poured through the record of nearly 1.5 million people released from prisons between 1980 and 2018 across 8 countries: America, Australia, Brazil, Canada, New Zealand, Norway, Scotland, and Sweden, so a wide variety of countries. And what they found was that the mortality rate was more than twice as high in that first week than just a month later.
So what are the main risk factors here during that seemingly very dangerous first few days, week after release?
What the researchers found was that alcohol and drug poisoning was the leading cause of death in all but one of the 8 countries examined. The exception was Brazil, where the leading cause was violence.
And so why should alcohol and drug poisoning be such a high risk factor during that time?
The likely reason is that when people are behind bars, they're under enforced abstinence. So that means their bodies lose the tolerance they would have developed towards drugs and alcohol. And once they're out and they try to take the same amount, they become very prone to overdosing.
But it's worth asking about the sample that we're talking about. I mean, what are the health conditions of people who go into prison in the first place, relative to a standard population, if you like?
Many people who go to prison are in poor health, both when they enter and when they leave. People who end up in prison tend to have higher rates of infections, cognitive disabilities, mental illness, and indeed addictions, which is partly why we see this pattern in the very first week when they're released. And they tend to have several of these health problems at once, and they're often rooted in abuse or trauma. So they have quite complex health needs.
Which are surely made more difficult in prison, the traumatic experience itself.
Well, maybe not. At least one study in the Netherlands, published in 2021, looked at that question, and it found that being in prison has no net effect on pre-existing health of inmates. In other words, if a person goes in unwell, they leave unwell, neither better off or worse off. And changing that depends on, of course, better healthcare services in prisons.
But coming back to the risks upon release, is there anything policy-wise to be done about once people get out of prison?
There are many things one could do and things that have been tried. So people who have opioid addiction, when they're released, they could be given naloxone, which is a drug that's used to treat opioid overdose. And in fact, this is something that has been done in Canada, Scotland, and other countries. Sometimes naloxone has been given to everyone leaving prison on the assumption that either they will need it or they will come into contact with someone who will. And of course, if ex-inmates have better access to mental health services in that first week, that could be very, very beneficial. They're often just released and have no housing, their relationships have broken down, they have nowhere to go. So understandably, they become more prone to going back to taking drugs or suicides. And of course, with the right healthcare while they're behind bars, they could be better prepared to face the outside world.
Slaveya, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
For as long as there's been sport, there have been unhappy fans.
Vishnu Padmanabhan is our Asia correspondent.
In the days of ancient Rome and gladiators, people would let athletes know how they felt by flipping the bird. Centuries later, the tradition is very much alive. In India, Hardik Pandya, a star cricketer, has been hit by a torrent of abuse during this season's Indian Premier League. It's not only been happening at away grounds, but also in front of his home crowd. His colleagues, ex-players and pundits have urged fans to back off. But fans are upset. Their anger was sparked when Hardik Pandya left the Gujarat Titans to sign for the Mumbai Indians. Fans of the Gujarat Titans were upset by the loss of their star player. Fans of the Mumbai Indians were unhappy because Mr. Pandya reportedly insisted that he replace Rohit Sharma as the captain of the team as part of his transfer. Mr. Sharma is hugely popular in Mumbai, and this was seen as treason. On top of all that, he's also the captain of the Indian cricket team. That meant fans across the country were upset by Mr. Pandya. Across sports, moves between rival teams can trigger similar reactions. Sometimes, booing can be the mildest form of protest. When the footballer Luis Figo moved from Barcelona to Real Madrid, fans were furious. So when he returned to Barcelona while playing for Real Madrid, he was greeted by a lot of boos, of course, but also other things. When he was taking a corner, a pig's head was thrown at him. One theory is that fans in sports see themselves as the upholders of their sport's unwritten moral code. And when this is broken, booing is the punishment that is triggered. Moving between rival teams is one transgression, but there are many ways to break this code. For instance, racing driver Emerson Fittipaldi was booed in 1993 after winning the prestigious Indy 500 car race. His crime was drinking orange juice instead of milk, as was the tradition for winners.
No, I'm not having the milk, thanks.
Now there's a first. Emerson, you're not going to drink the milk.
Well, I'm going to drink the orange juice. That's my producing, and I'm going to have this time orange juice. I produce orange juice.
back in Sao Paulo, Brazil, he produces the orange juice, so he's going to go that way.
Booing can also be a way to protest more serious things. During an international match last year, England footballer Jordan Henderson was jeered after his move to a club in Saudi Arabia. He had been a vocal LGBT plus ambassador, and his move was seen as a betrayal of the movement. But most booing is done for a more simple reason: to rattle the opposition or pressure the referee. It can also be great fun. There is nothing that unites people better than a common enemy. But things can also go too far. Mob mentality can have profound consequences. In America, athletes playing in the NFL have been jeered for taking the knee in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. In Australia, Adam Goods, an Aboriginal Australian rules football star, asked that a girl who called him an ape be removed from the stands. And after that incident, he was booed everywhere he played and eventually forced to retire. This type of booing, of course, is merely a manifestation of bigger issues in society. To stop it, you need to address those issues first. However, for the more trivial instances of booing, the most effective response can be a good performance. Playing well can silence the crowd. Hardik Pandya can do that by scoring centuries for Mumbai, because as in any sport, the best way to get supporters on board is often by winning.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show. You can get in touch at podcasts@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
With the highest number of young STEM graduates per capita in the EU, Ireland has the people and skills your company needs to succeed here. IDA Ireland, the National Investment Development Agency, can help you find and nurture the people you need to internationalise and thrive. Our talent is just one of the extraordinary benefits Ireland has to offer. Learn more at idaireland.com. Invest in extraordinary.